The date is the 15th of June, 1978, and this is a continuation of an interview with Lieutenant General Lane by Dr. Roy with the assistance of Chris May. Now, we left off, Reg, almost, well, I think it was just about the end of the war. Yeah.
That's right.
One thing you didn't tell me, what were you doing on VE Day?
Well, I was at Tiger Force, and we had a stand-down on VE Day. I remember old Sir Hugh Pugh Lloyd, Air Marshal, the Commander-in-Chief of Tiger Force, declared a stand-down, a one-day stand-down for VE Day. So I went and I grabbed an airplane and flew up to York, because, of course, by this time I was engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent the day up in Yorkshire. And I can remember that one interesting little thing there, a brewery in Yorkshire, John Smith's of Tadcaster, used to make the best beer in Yorkshire. They had apparently been brewing a beer since 1943, constantly rebrewing it. And as soon as the morning of VE Day came along, they bottled it in little nips, very small bottles, and whipped it around to all of their breweries. And they gave each brewery about two or three cases to give to their customers. And I can remember that evening or having one of these bottles, and my God, it was powerful. It was just a very small bottle of beer, but it was about three double whiskeys. And I watched somebody, one person who'd been drinking a fair amount of scotch, and take one of these and literally collapse. Yeah, incredible. I still have. I managed to collect another one, and then they did the same thing for the coronation of the Queen, John Smith, and I still have three bottles of those beers, as a matter of fact.
You mean with beer in it?
Yes, with beer in it. Of course, it's really good now, but it really is collector's items.
Yeah.
But it was just a very simple label on the bottle, you know, a little nips, only, what, about 5 inches high, and it had just Victory. That's all it had. Victory, 1944. That's all it was. And then very small print of the one, John Smith's Tadcaster.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah.
But that was where I spent VE Day, and then, of course, immediately I had to go back because, Sir Hugh Pugh Lloyd had set a stand down. A day's work at that time when we were trying to get ready for flight to get out to the Pacific was a loss of an awful lot of paperwork and planning. So there was no real holiday. It was a question of right back at it again. And so I had to go back early the next morning and fly back and be in the office, and away we were. And I've told you where I was, VJ Day. I was literally getting on board the bus to head out to Okinawa when there was the delay, and then, of course, everything was canceled. Well, then by that time, I guess I had also made up my mind that I would like to stay in the Air Force. I suppose I had rationalized it in my own mind, and I had, as a matter of fact, because when I was interviewed shortly after that, I guess... it certainly would be before the end of 45. I was interviewed in London. On this, I had applied. They came up with application forms. Are you interested in staying in the Air Force? And I had received one, and I said yes. Wrote back and said yes. So I was called up to London for an interview. And I can remember one of the questions I was asked was, "Why did you do you want to stay in the Air Force?" And I said, "Well, very simply, I'm convinced that we haven't seen the end of war. That the USSR is not going to stop being aggressive. And if there is going to be another war, I would just as soon be up to date with the art of war than leave the service and then come back in a few years' time and be that much further behind in mm-hmm. modern war. Therefore, I'd like to stay in." Well, I had also said to myself that I was then a group captain, that I would, realizing that there would be probably a small force, that I would accept a flight lieutenant. A flight lieutenancy would be, and I would still stay in the service. And then they said, "Would you stay in if you were made a wing commander?" And of course, I just fell off my chair and, like a shot, said, "Yes, very definitely I would stay in if I was made a wing commander." Well, that was the interview, and I didn't hear anything until quite a bit later, when I received notification that I had been accepted into the post-war Air Force and with the rank of wing commander. So, of course, I was some delighted at that stage, because having known a fair amount about the pre-war Air Force by that time and what ages meant, because I was still literally, you see, only, what, in 45, I was still only 25, so yeah. the A wing commander at that age in the post-war service was not to be sneezed at. Well, the other thing I mentioned was the fact that Canada had decided to assist with the rehabilitation of Europe by providing a transport wing of aircraft. And the wing was to be made up of three squadrons, 435, 436, and 437. And these squadrons had all been out in Burma. So they had come back from Burma and then were reorganized to be a part of the immediate post-war transport service to the continent. And the continent being as far east as Greece and as far north as Norway, including Berlin. One squadron, I was offered the position of base commander at Odium, which was to have been one of the bases. There were two bases. One was Odium, and the other was Down Ampany, which very rapidly became damp agony for the squadrons who were there, because it wasn't...
How do you spell that?
Down Ampany, A-M-P-N-E-Y, Ampany, Down Ampany.
And where was it?
It was... let's see, I'm not too sure which county it would have been in.
Where was it called?
Odium was in Buckinghamshire. So it must have been in Bucks somewhere. It wasn't very far away from Odium, so it would be in Buckinghamshire somewhere in that general area.
Odium and damp agony.
Yeah, Odium. Odium, of course, was a very, very famous Roman city, as the name would imply, Odium.
Yeah.
And the high street in Odium was just a delight with old, old, old houses and all kinds of history. One of the pubs, the George, was where French prisoners used to be kept in the cellars when they were being brought back to London and all this sort of stuff. It was a great area for history. The airfield itself was a pre-war airfield, and had been, it was a field where Goering, when he made his visit to England, they entertained him at Odium, because it was a brand new station, apparently, when Goering came to England at that time. And, that was where they had the show. But it was built on the top of a hill. And I mean, on the top of a hill. It was built in those days when, I suppose, the biplanes and short takeoff and what have you. And, the country in that part was fairly rolling. And here was this airfield on the top of this hill. And they had, of course, by the end of the war, they had runways on it. And the runways literally came to a grinding halt. And from there, there was a gully right down. Well, I was offered the job as base commander, and of course I accepted, because I wanted to stay in England for a little while. We had, Barbara and I had agreed that we would get married in December. So it was a question then of the wedding in England, and then continuing on with this job. Well, I was delighted, because I thought it would be very interesting, and as it turned out, it was. At first, I had the station at the base, and one of the squadrons had been put to Brussels and was operating out of Brussels. But the Belgians wanted to get the airfield back to civil operation as soon as possible. It was, and therefore they wanted the military out. And it was agreed that the squadron would come back to England. This was soon after I took over the base. Then we would then have all three squadrons of 25 aircraft each, 75 Dakotas, located in England. And this squadron, of course, had a fair collection of booze in the squadron bar at Belgium. They had deliberated a fair amount of stuff, and it was a question: could we get it back? Because it was all part of the squadron fund at that stage. And I had an awful altercation with the customs people about trying to get that stuff back into England without paying customs on it. Customs would have made it absolutely impossible to do it, and I guaranteed that nothing would go off the base and that would only be consumed right on the base and that sort of thing, but no bloody way would they play ball. So then it became a game of cat and mouse with the customs people for the next few months, because every time an aircraft went into Brussels, it would load up with, throw on two or three cases of the stock that was there, primarily wines and liqueurs and champagne. And then we'd have a jeep come in at nighttime, and then have a jeep go down the runway in formation with the Dakota, you see, with the door open and heaving this stuff out into the jeep, and then it would disappear and finally wind up in the mess. And I don't know if the customs ever really did know what we were doing, but we got all of that stock out of Brussels and into Odium. I was so mad because they wouldn't play ball with us. We got it back, and it didn't go off the base. We used it right there. Well, the function of the wing, it was called 120 Wing, was, as it very rapidly evolved, was to do all of the transport services required by the British government, a little bit for the Canadian government, but primarily the British government, in Western Europe, from Norway down to Greece. The RAF, there was so much required for the Far East that the RAF really did what they called the trunk routes. They did all the way out to the Middle East and the Far East, and all of their effort was devoted entirely in that field. So that 120 Wing became the sole transport for the whole of Europe for both the British and the Canadian governments, and thus it became extremely interesting. We had to do things like evacuate DPs, displaced persons, from Norway. Now that was one of the first functions. One of the first priorities was to try and return all the displaced persons to their various homelands. And Norway was full of DPs. And I went up to do a recce up to Oslo to do a recce. Very soon after the end of the war, things were happening fairly fast. I can't remember exact dates, but I remember it was the early fall, so it was not too far after the BJD thing had all been sorted out. And I was appalled by the conditions in Norway, absolutely appalled. The Norwegians had managed to get a couple of people into Fornebu, which was the air base at Oslo, and a Norwegian colonel who had trained in Canada was the base commander. He only had about 20 people there, but a lot of Germans were still there, and they were still running the base, literally. But food was literally non-existent. Other than seafood, there was no bread, no vegetables. It really was a straight fish diet. It was incredible. He put on a big dinner, what he considered to be a big dinner, in his home, with the Germans doing all the serving, and it was a lobster dinner, and it was literally a lobster dinner and some of that rather sort of like Melba toast, which the Scandinavians are so famous for. And that was it. That was the whole dinner, this big bang-up dinner. And it was literally lobster happened to come right out of the sea because it was there, and I don't know where he got this Melba toast from, but that was a dinner. Well, it was obvious that we had a big job to do because there were a lot of displaced people, and they were from all over bloody Europe. There were Jews, Poles, Czechs, French, they were from all over. Anyway, we started a run. And we were flogging airplanes into Fornebu and loading up with the dependents, with these displaced persons, just as fast as we could load the airplanes, and then flying them to wherever we had been told to take them by the control center. And it could have been anywhere, and it was literally anywhere. I went up on several of the trips, but it became so depressing that I really stopped going, and even the crews were beginning to get very depressed because these people were in terrible condition, and it was not uncommon to have rough air, but over the straits. We had to go from Fornebu to Copenhagen and then refuel and then on to wherever we were going. And, oh dear me, those people would get violently ill in the back, and they were just the old bucket seats. So they were really the paratroop airplanes, that's what they were. They weren't comfortable seats we have today. They were straight bucket seats. And there were women with babies, and oh, it was just terrible. Everyone would get sick as a dog, and there was nothing you could do for them. They would literally just lie on the floor, almost on the verge of dying. It really was a disaster. So it just got to me, finally. I stopped going up until we had a nasty accident. An airplane took off, loaded with the dependents from Fornebu, went to Copenhagen, couldn't get in because of fog, decided to go back to Fornebu. By that time, of course, Fornebu had fogged in. He had no choice but to do what they call a beacon letdown, and he plowed into the big mountain, which is right behind Fornebu, and of course, everybody was killed on the airplane. Well, of course, now we're peacetime. This is a little different thing to losing, having a bomber crash as it was during the war, where you simply wrote some letters and said, tough, sorry about all this, and that was it. Here we had to have a full-blown investigation, and I talked to London and asked if I could be made the chairman of the board, the board of inquiry, because I wanted to get into this, because it was obviously going to affect the operation and the wing, if we were going to continue, and we had some lessons to learn. What I did, and it was very obvious what had happened, it was just simply a matter of a beacon let down. People who are just, our pilots had not had enough experience in this kind of operation, of having to get into a base when the weather was lousy, with minimum navigation aids. And, of course, in his case, the poor pilot really had no alternative because there was no place to go. It was all socked in. So he made a crack, took a crack at it and missed it on the overshoot. He plowed into this mountain. Well, that was a kind of a bad thing. But then that was one task. Another one task of the wing was to fly messages, spare parts, anything in the way of freight, to things like Nuremberg, where the trials were being set up. And the wing really basically supported the Nuremberg trials from England. And I used to go to those fairly frequently, and then everybody was there, go sit in. And I was, of course, I had entree into the trials, so I could go and sit in the gallery and listen and watch the trials. And I used to do this for about an hour. But it became very boring. Those trials went on for a long time, as you recall, and there were so many legal hassles that the only thing you did was to go and see the defendants who were all in dock, and unless it happened, unless one of them was being interrogated or was making a statement, it really was rather boring. And, of course, as well, we used to support the prison, and so I used to be able to get into the prison, and I only did that about once, because, again, it was a simple matter of walking through the prison and seeing them all in their cells. It was,
what was your impression of them, by the way?
Oh, my impression was pretty bitter. I didn't have much time for them, I suppose. My reaction at that time was, why the hell are we wasting all this time? Why don't we just take them out and hang the rascals, or shoot them, or do something? And, of course, it was soon after that that Goering, if you remember, took poison.
Yeah, that's right.
And that happened in between the trips. And when I went down, of course, it was great. The place was buzzing because of Goering having taken poison, and the security was tightened up enormously in the place. I got to know the sergeant who organized it, sergeant who was responsible for the trials, the billing, sort of the administrator. And the reason why was that he had a room in the building and always had a beautiful keg of German beer on tap right in his room. And his room was never locked, so if ever you wanted a good German beer, you just had to walk in and take a tap, and buy it and drink it, and knock it back. But it was fascinating.
I was just wondering what you thought about during the Nuremberg trials itself as an airman or a soldier. Didn't it strike you odd that now we were the victors were trying the losers and things like that? Did that strike you at all?
No. The niceties of what would have happened if the reverse had been the case, I suppose it probably went through my mind, but it was quite obvious to me what would have happened if the reverse had happened. I think that all the military leaders in the West would literally have been put against a wall and shot. I don't think there'd been any doubt about it. And I suppose my reaction was, why the hell aren't we doing the same thing to them? The legal niceties of letting them have sort of the truly democratic principle of trial by jury or trial by court and so forth. And the Russians, if you recall, also. I was very close to these things in the sense that I was there frequently. And, of course, the papers were full of what was going on, and the Russians were really dragging their feet. They were making things very difficult in the process, the pure process of the trial, because of their law, if you will, or their approach to law, international law, as opposed to the West. And Burkitt was the, I can't remember whether Burkitt was the chief judge or whether he was the British prosecutor. But Burkitt, I knew, had stayed at his place in England, as a matter of fact. When he was Sir Norman Burkitt, he was one of the justices in England. I had got to know him through Burt Mullard. So there was a personal interest, in a way, if you will, with the trials, as well as the straight trial of
I think what I was trying to get at, though, sir, in a historic context, is that prior to this, you know, people hadn't been tried, per se.
Oh, yes, that's true.
And then, you know, if you carry it on, you start with Nuremberg, and then you carry it on to the Cali incident, I guess, after Vietnam, where a country's trying its own soldiers for action.
No, I didn't... I suppose I was still so darn busy and so wrapped up that I really didn't get too involved with that kind of thing. Again, we were doing other things. These DPs really was that really got to me. I was terribly depressed about that. And whereas the Nuremberg trial was the two, as you can see, were in complete conflict. Here was the condition of all these DPs as a result of all these people who were at Nuremberg. And they caused the condition of all these DPs. I was not very sympathetic. I didn't have time. I wasn't rational, really, I suppose. My reaction was literally, don't waste time.
Yeah.
Well,
can I ask you another question? I imagine at this time, too, your wing would be flying out prisoners of war. Let's say our.
Yes. We recovered. Only the odd case, somebody who was suddenly turned up, because immediately VE Day happened and was squared away, the Bomber Command was used to go into whatever bases there were to fly out. In other words, bombers were used to fly POWs back. And you wouldn't get many in a bomber, but they had lots of bombers. And hell, you only had to put five in one bomber, and you got 5,000 people lifted in one trip.
Yeah.
So it went that way. No, the POWs were returned to England very, very quickly. Those who were fit enough flew, and that was how they got back. No, we didn't get involved in that. But we did. All of the, I suppose, the timing was such that the Allies had looked after their own. Now they were looking after the rest of Europe,
mm-hmm.
and which was, as I say, a fairly terrible thing. We went to Greece. Again, there was the requirement for communications to Greece because there were forces still down there. And we would take VIPs, we would take replacement personnel, we would take spare parts that were panicky, that couldn't wait to go by sea,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. And every airplane that went out was loaded. We had a constant backlog of freight or personnel at both Odeum and Down Anthony. The requirement for the airlift was great. And we never did catch up. It was always a backlog, and when the backlog got too big, we had to let the RAF group, who were controlling all of this airlift, both the trunk routes as well as for Europe, we had to let them know that we couldn't hack anymore, stop, or take some of the stuff away and give us higher priority. But it was literally that. Because the DAC really wouldn't take all that much, and you didn't have that much range.
Well, now, these squadrons, were these three Canadian squadrons?
Three Canadian squadrons, 435, 436, 437, completely manned by Canadians. No question now of unified crews with the Allies. No, these are all Canadian now. Every single person was a Canadian. And I was a base commander, and then I took over the wing. Oh, in a matter of 2 or 3 months, I suppose, I became the wing commander. Same rank as group captain, but I now ran the wing. And it was at that time when the ground crew were beginning to act up, because there was a great demand from a lot of the ground crew to go back home. And many of them had been sent over at the very latter part of the war as zombies, or those people who had not volunteered to go overseas, but were bloody well made to go overseas. So there was an element. The war was over, but they were still being sent over. And there was an element here that was very, very anti. All they wanted to do was be demobilized and get back to civilian life. So it got progressively worse. And finally, I went to London, and I said, I think we better have some undercover people. I don't care if it's RCMP or who the hell you get. But obviously, at Odeum, we've got some agitators who are really stirring up the troops, and we're headed for trouble. So, London, I don't think they really took me too seriously. They said, yes, okay, they would think about it. I got back at them about a week later and said, have you done anything about getting anybody in here? Because I want to catch whoever it is, if there are ringleaders, and get them out. Because I had heard by that time that they were having meetings at night with no lights on in the barracks, so that no one knew. And there was somebody there who was really stirring up trouble. What are we doing in Europe? Why are we here? Why aren't we all back home? And literally leading up to a mutiny, which really was the start. Well, finally, London realized what was happening, and I said, I don't want anything about it. You control it from your security in London. All I want to know is that you're doing something, and don't tell me, because the less I know about it, the better, until you find out something, and then let me know. Well, they said they would, but of course it was British almost locking the door after the horse had bolted, because shortly thereafter, one morning, the troops, they all downed tools. They literally refused to service the airplanes, and to all intents and purposes, it was a mutiny. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to the troops, and obviously it wasn't going to move them, and then finally the commander, I guess he was the acting commander-in-chief in London, came up and spoke to them. And by this time, Ottawa was in the act, because, of course, it was in the papers. There was a big howl over this thing. And the opposition in the House were saying about getting Canadians home, and they just leapt on this, because here is Canada doing something that we really didn't have to do, and why couldn't all of our troops come home, and all that, mm-hmm. certainly, which the opposition would make of any kind of a situation like that. So the government agreed that they would start to rehabilitate people who... unless they had volunteered, really volunteered to stay. And I suppose it would really be the beginning of the peacetime forces, a volunteer force.
Yeah.
So that was what I really wanted. I only wanted people who were willing to stay.
Yeah.
Well, as a result, we began to get some people from Canada who volunteered to go over, who just wanted the opportunity to go and spend some time in England, because they knew it wasn't going to go on forever.
Yeah.
And there was no war, and it could be a pretty fascinating experience. And the agitators all went home. And then, of course, the wing settled down to do an enormous amount of good work, and it just became routine. Routine, routine, routine. We flew all kinds of people all over the place, and it was a smooth operation. We had one or two minor accidents, but no fatalities or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It became a very, very efficient operation. On the other course, it had its lighter moments as well. The black market by this time was roaring.
I was going to ask you.
And the troops, the air crew, of course, were involved in this. Many of them were, not all of them. I had to stay Simon Pure, and I must admit it was awfully hard. One of my trips to Copenhagen, I hadn't been in my damn hotel room for more than seconds, and there was a rap on my door, and a Dane came in, and he had about four or five beautiful cameras, German cameras. I suppose he'd pinched off Germans or somewhere, but
mm-hmm.
And he threw them on the bed, and he said, and they were all beautiful cameras, and he said, your choice for a carton of cigarettes. And a carton of cigarettes was $1 in those days.
That's right.
So I could have had any one of those cameras for $1. Well, I thought, I better not get involved, and so I chased him out of the room. But from there on, it was awfully difficult not to get involved, because there was a lot of money to be made. And we had cases, humorous ones as well, I suppose, in many ways. But the boys who went to Greece, to Italy, would bring back the little tiny carved cameos that would go into cameo rings,
mm-hmm.
carved out of good Italian ivory, marble, or whatever the stone was.
Yeah.
And those darn things, of course, in London, the market, there was no way that anything in the way of jewelry could get into London, so there was a great demand in London, and the boys could sell those things in London for £1 a piece.
Oh,
and they were buying them for a cigarette a piece.
Yeah.
I mean, you see the enormous profit that we made. And the other thing was that they could take a bag full in their flight bag. Now, their flight bag was where they kept all of their maps and navigation books and all that sort of thing. Just a briefcase.
Yeah.
Well, you could put a lot of cameos in a briefcase. Well, this was going on, and I used to, I suppose, periodically, once a week, I'd have to get a stand up and say, now, watch the black market thing, because if you get caught, you're for the high jump, and nothing I can do for you. It's illegal, and that's it. And then turn a blind eye. You had no choice. And one pilot came in to the accountant officer at Odeon, who was still a very good friend of mine. And he said to the accountant officer, have you got any £5 notes? And the £5 note in those days was literally a great big white sheet. It must have been about, 12 by 9,
yeah,
something
big,
like that. And you had to initial it every time. It was a heck of a big note. And the accounts officer said, £5 notes, why? He said, £5 notes are are sometimes difficult to pass. He said, what the hell do you want 5-pound notes? And he had two briefcases, and he put them up on the desk in the office, and he opened up, and they were full of 1-pound notes. And he said, I'm just getting fed up carrying all this money around with me, all these 1-pound notes. I want to get them down into a smaller space. That's why I want 5-pound notes, which was the largest bill of circulation. Yeah. Well, he said, get the hell out of here. Get out of my office. Take all that. Go. So this was the sort of silly thing that was going on. I know of another case. I didn't know at the time, but I found out later that one of the pilots managed to buy into a big brewery as a result of all of his the profits he made from the black market.
Yes, this is quite literally too. I think the Canadians, nevertheless, I suppose because of tradition, never operated on the grand scale that Americans did.
No.
Where you get a whole train load.
No. This was all pretty small stuff, and it had to be because what could you put in a bloody airplane? And booze. You couldn't flog booze. It was just too big. And customs met every airplane. We still had to clear customs. Every flight by that time had to go through customs. So when I'd warned the aircrew about this, and I said, you know, you're sticking your neck out. If you get caught, if they should take... I didn't... After I had heard about the cameo incident, I warned them. I said, no, if a customs officer asks to see your flight bag, you have no... There's nothing that will... You can't prevent him. And if you're if you've got a whole pile of cameos in there, and you can't explain it, you're obviously in trouble. Well, that didn't prevent or stop a lot of it. But it was all small stuff. It couldn't be on the grand scale. There just wasn't... with airplanes, there's a limit to how far you can go. Stockings became a big thing too, silk stockings, because they could be handled in small packages, and they were worth a hell of a lot of money when they began to get them in Italy and pick them up there for nothing, and again cigarettes, and then could flog them in London. I forget what, 5 pound a pair or something like that.
Yeah, I was wondering how you and your crew related down to non-combat flying. As you say, it became routine. You were flying here, you were flying there. Was there a big change? I mean, how did it affect the psychological?
There was an enormous psychological change. An enormous. And the big change, the big psychological requirement in change was to go from an atmosphere of taking chances, of taking risks. And if a degree of bravado as well, which could be such as showing off a wee bit, doing some low flying, or as we used to do in the bombers, we'd take on the Spitz and some fighter cooperation and wind up right on the deck, flying around at the deck and taking all kinds of chances, probably after lunch and having had a beer lunch. Really, that sort of thing. It was pretty sticky. Now, no, you were carrying passengers, and so safety became the big issue. And to go from the wartime flying to one of where safety was a real jolt.